Hey, welcome back to Community in Code. I'm your host, Chris Reynolds. My guest today is Carrie Dills, who started building websites back in the mid-90s before a lot of us were doing it. She took a hard left turn somewhere in the middle to go work for Starbucks for a decade, and when she came back around 2012, she discovered WordPress and has been one of its most dedicated educators ever since. We talk about what it's actually like to build a LinkedIn learning course from scratch, about the teaching as learning philosophy, which is something I could talk about for hours, and what building your own website looked like when stuff like HotScripts existed and SourceForge and GitHub did not. But a big chunk of our conversation is about FAIR, Federated and Independent Repositories, the Linux Foundation-backed project that she co-chairs that's trying to solve the supply chain security problem for WordPress plugins, themes, and the broader open source ecosystem. We get into what that actually means practically, where FAIR is right now after a year that had some real ups and downs, and why the Typo3 hackathon in March was a genuinely exciting development. Carrie is thoughtful and honest about where things stand, including where FAIR still has ground to cover. Let's dive in with Carrie Dills. Welcome to Community in Code, the podcast where we talk to the human beings behind the commits. And my human being today is Carrie Dills, who is a longtime WordPress developer, freelancer, consultant, and educator. You've been doing like training stuff for quite a while, and also one of the co-chairs, I think, is your official title of the FAIR project, which is Federated and Independent Repositories. We've had a couple, I think, we've talked to people from FAIR before. We've talked about FAIR, certainly. But anyway, welcome to the show, Carrie. Tell us about yourself.
Cool, Chris. Thanks for having me. Yeah. Well, you did a pretty solid job on the professional intro there. But I have other things to note. I don't know. I went to the movies this past weekend for the first time, and I don't know, a very long time, because I usually don't go to theaters these days. I don't know, post-COVID era, I just don't find myself going. So that was my big excitement. I went to a movie.
I've been to the movies, I want to say like four times since COVID. And like really, it wasn't like zero times before like last year or something. Like there was definitely like 5 years before we actually went to a movie in person. And then it was like weird, right? Like you're in the theater, like, oh, this is a thing that I used to do.
Except I'm kind of like, wow. I can't pause it if I need to go take a bio break. I've got to get up and miss a movie if I want to go refill a beverage or anything. So I've kind of gotten spoiled, honestly, to just being on my couch watching movies.
I mean, like after our kids were born, like the amount of time that it took to watch a movie from start to finish between my partner and I went from like, yeah, we could back to back movie nights. We could watch like, you know, two movies and have a doubleheader. Went from that to like, yeah, we'll maybe get through this movie by the end of the week.
The struggle is real.
Well, so one of the things I like to talk about on the podcast is sort of like what got you into, like, what's your sort of origin story? What's your origin story for WordPress? What's your origin story for tech? Like, what sort of led to the decisions that lead you to the person that you end up being here as a co-chair of this weird, independent, federated repository project thing?
It's a slightly windy road, which is probably true of many people's careers. I was studying something completely unrelated in college, and I went to college literally the last century. And I took an HTML class just as an elective and was very intrigued and started. That was kind of my first taste of the web, and this was mid-90s. And when I got out, that was the only actual skill that I had, was building web pages. And so I found freelance work for that, started doing it. And that just kind of snowballed into a small career in web development and consultancy. And at that point in time, it was, you know, ancient technology now. But I've had a sideways step in my career. I've got tired of tech and thought I want to go open a coffee shop, and I'll go, well, I don't know anything about how to, I know how to make coffee and that's about it. I don't know anything about the business aspect of it. So I decided I needed some help and went to learn from Starbucks Corporation. Learned on their dime and ended up staying for about a decade, a little under that. And then I actually, it was somebody that I was working with that told me about WordPress. So I started dabbling in that, and I was sort of amazed at just how advanced that seemed compared to like rolling your own CMS back in the day. Yeah. I was like, oh my gosh, all this stuff just exists out of the box. So I started working with it, and then at one point determined, hey, I can make more money doing this than I can slinging coffee. So I made the switch back to WordPress and, or back to tech. And that was probably around 2012 or so. And then here I am, I've just kind of hung around, fell in love.
So what version of WordPress was that sort of like, or version like era, like what, where was WordPress at when you first sort of tacked on, like jumped on and saw that it was like groundbreaking compared to what you knew?
I think we were somewhere in the early version three. I can't remember what point release it was, but I mean, you go back and look at it now and it looks like a dinosaur, but it looked pretty cool then.
Yeah. Well, I ask because my first WordPress version was 2-something. I want to say like 2.5 or thereabouts. And for me, like it wasn't compared to roll. I mean, I had rolled my own a little bit. Mostly I like found like a script that like there used to be a website. I've mentioned this a couple times. There used to be a website called Hot Scripts, which sounds super bad now. it had a little chili pepper, and like it was just like free open source like PHP scripts, and it's probably like ASP.NET and like I don't know Perl scripts probably on there, but really like it was like you could download something that somebody made and then put it on your website and use it. And one of the things I found there. One of the things was like some sort of JavaScript-y thing where there would be a block in your HTML on the web page that you're building that becomes editable. And so there's another sort of like backend page thing that you can access through a password or whatever. And then somebody could just log in and edit the text on the page. But what they're actually doing is actually editing the HTML in that section. Kind of like a CMS light sort of thing. So I did that for a couple like projects that I built freelance. But then the other thing that I had done for myself was I was web blogging when it was called a weblog. It's a log of the things that you did on your website. And when I started doing that, it was all HTML, and I was like FTPing it up to my server and whatever. And then at some point I was like, okay, well there's stuff for this now. So I found on Hot Scripts a blogging platform called Sblog, which was really like, it was like somebody rolled their own CMS sort of thing. And similar to the origin story of WordPress, where like the maintainer kind of goes off and disappears for a while. I mean, that's a thing that we've seen it all across open source for forever. It's just a thing that happens because people get busy and they stop having time for their side projects. So he disappeared, and there's a bunch of problems or bugs or weird things. I'm like, okay, this isn't sustainable. And at that point, I think a friend of mine from college had talked about WordPress. So I'm like, okay, I wonder if I can move my stuff over there. So that was about the 2-point-something era. Old internet is weird.
And I'm sure we'll look back at what's currently so cool and be like, oh.
Yeah. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about like recently, well, especially with like a lot of people talking about like moving their, well, okay. So a conversation that has come up, I've seen a bunch of times, recently, like in literally in the last couple of weeks, is this idea that not every site needs a CMS. Like Yoast blogged about that when he transferred his blog over to Astro. I'm seeing it on like LinkedIn posts and whatever. But like, I don't know, you and me have been around for a while. That's not a new conversation.
Right. There was a point in
That's a thing
time
we've been
when
talking for 20 years. Like that's like old.
That's an interesting way to look at it. We're sort of maybe going back to a simpler web.
Yeah, I mean, like it's interesting to me because like I've like this is a conversation that's been ongoing for 20 years. But now it's got like the AI spin. Like now, oh, you don't need a CMS for your website. Well, you never needed a CMS for your website. It helps with some things, but obviously that was always like an option. Obviously there are always other things, but now the thing is, well, you can have AI build it for you and then you don't need it. Your CMS, like, okay.
Ooh to the AI having it built, not ooh to the not needing a CMS. There are not every, not everything needs the same tool.
But yeah, so somewhere along the way, you started teaching WordPressy things. How did that happen?
That was back in the early days of my entry to WordPress. I was learning WordPress off of what was then called lynda.com from an instructor named Morten Rinn Hendrickson. And he was very involved in the WordPress space very on. And I kind of hate the word thought or the term thought leader, but he very much is that still. And a lot of respect for him. And anyhow, was learning WordPress from him on that platform. And then had a conversation with him at a WordCamp one time, and he was like, "Have you ever considered?" And I was like, no, but that's interesting." So I went out and did my first course, and kind of fell in love with it, fell in love with the process, and determined that that had, I think there's always been an inner instructor in me, or I love teaching others and empowering others through helping them understand the why behind things, not just copy pasting. And that led to now at this point a decade long with LinkedIn Learning.
Yeah, so I also kind of a I it wasn't Morton. Morton never talked to me. I had started doing presentations at WordCamps. It was after one of the presentations I did. I think it was just a presentation that I did on like intro to theme development or something. Someone from Pluralsight, which is a online developer training platform, or was, I think it still exists now. Pluralsight is actually based or was based in Utah, a little north of me. Someone from Pluralsight happened to be at the WordCamp. I don't know if they were scouting or what, but they asked me after my talk, "Would you be interested in doing this thing?" And I'm like, "Sure." And the way they posed it was, "Oh, it'll basically be the same as what you're doing." This is when the narrator comes over and does the voiceover. Says it was not the same. It was similar, but building a like a 4 to 8 hour like course is very different than designing a like a 30-minute talk on a subject, right?
Sure.
But that
It'll
was
be
really,
easy, they said.
oh
It'll be
yeah, it'll be
fun.
easy. It'll be fun. And that was very early days in Pluralsight's history too. And they had so their history was that they originally were like on-site training for like really deep Microsoft specific stuff. And then they realized at some point that they could do this online and not have to send people to offices. And then they started expanding their course catalog, and it was when they were expanding their course catalog that I came in. So really like greenfield. They had nothing, they had very little content that wasn't about Microsoft something. So it was like, "We don't really know what we want you to do. And also like you're doing all of this stuff. So we're gonna give you like you will reimburse you for like Camtasia and we'll reimburse you for a mic we'll have a couple people that'll like help you through like a little bit and we can guide, but like you're doing all the editing and all the
Oh,
preparation and
wow.
all the everything, and we're just gonna review it at the end." Yeah, that was that's not how it is anymore, I don't think.
Okay, because that's a big ask, because not only do you have to be a subject matter expert in whatever it is that you're teaching, but that's, oh, by the way, you also have to understand production, you have to understand editing and this particular software suite and a
to be an
whole
audio
set of,
engineer. Yep.
right, all the things.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. It was
So.
very, very bootstrappy back then. Very, very bootstrappy. Yeah. So I mean, a friend of the show, friend of mine, Gary Kovar. I don't think I've had him on here yet. But he started doing LinkedIn learning classes a couple years ago. So I know a little bit about his process from that. What was the process like for you when you first started doing Lynda, right? It was Lynda before his LinkedIn purchased it. Yeah.
It's I'm trying to remember how the like those first few courses went. They've evolved a lot over the years. It sounds a lot more structured than what you're describing
Oh yeah.
at Pluralsight back in the day. But it would start with just a pitch for the course. What's the course? Who's the target audience? What's the learning objective? That sort of thing. And then a table of contents that would support that learning outcome. And over the years, it's kind of stuck to that core format, but with a few more, they want you to, it's more platform specific, I think. So like, what are other classes that might be a prerequisite to this? What are other classes that you might recommend to
Like
your
learning
learner?
paths,
Exactly,
yeah.
exactly. So it's you're kind of left to your own when it comes to actually writing the content, creating the content, all of that, but they give you a good structure around it to help you think about how a learner might progress through pieces of information to get to, from point A to point B. So I've appreciated that. It's taught me a lot about how to deliver, even in like giving WordCamp talks, like how to deliver information in a coherent way. And then they have full post-production support. So it's literally drop the mic and fly home, and it's in their hands. And I don't know, like Pluralsight, did they do any marketing for you or for your course, or was it?
There was a period of time when you could have been featured in an email, a newsletter.
Okay.
And then after that, I think they had so much content that the chances of you being featured in the newsletter went down. No, there was never really any marketing officially. And one of the things like they had author summits. So they call them authors, Pluralsight authors. I don't know what LinkedIn calls you.
Instructors.
Instructors. Okay, that's good. Yeah, Pluralsight authors. So there's author summits that they had for a number of years, and that was I went to one of the early ones. I might have been the first one, maybe the second one, because it was actually in their office, and then they got big enough that they couldn't hold it in the office anymore. That was really good because you got to talk to other people and figure out what other people were doing, which there really wasn't any way to like to get that sort of a feedback from other people that are doing the same thing, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that I learned pretty quickly is like there were a couple of people that were doing Pluralsight courses that were like well known, particularly in the Microsoft educational whatever space. And so like their names specifically would just carry weight. And obviously the ones that had names that had an established following, whatever, they obviously did really, really well. And those are obviously also the courses that tended to get more viewers and whatever. And so like there is like a natural gravity that kind of came. And so like if you came in with your own sort of like personal brand or whatever, then maybe you could use that and that could sort of and then for everyone else it was like, okay, how do I build that personal brand? So that becomes a whole thing that I had to think about in like the 2010s, somewhere in there as
Yeah.
I'm like and yeah, so the mark and so like you were free to market your own stuff, but yeah, there was not really a whole lot of official push from them, which was Which, yeah, it's everything is hard. Everything's
That part sounds about the same.
hard. What about I'm interested 'cause so you're talking about how you were learning from Morton, and then he comes in and kind of asks you, or have you thought about doing this yourself? So there's at least one other person, even just within the platform, who's doing the thing that you're doing. Were you specifically l thinking about or looking at topics that you could do that would be sort of like, I don't know, l like how are you distinguishing the things that you were working on that would make it distinct and different from what he was teaching and talking about?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think is not that you won't find overlapping content in the LinkedIn Learning Library. You certainly will, but I think they're very intentional about like course topics and trying to not have things that are competing, for example. So when at the time I started, the Genesis framework was my jam. And so I kicked it off but just by doing a couple of Genesis courses. And then from there, it sort of rolled off into other things. Morton was stepping, doing less WordPress content and starting in on other types of content. And so it left kind of a nice hole that I could fill for teaching WordPress related things. And then I eventually spun off and started doing not just WordPress specific, but more front endy things. I don't know if that totally answers your question.
No, it I mean, I always think about that because like when I started at Pluralsight, like I could say anything about WordPress. You know, like literally like there was zero. I was competing with no one. So like that space was like totally open. So like then I had to figure out and narrow down like, okay, how do I figure out what I want to talk about? So like obviously the first thing that I did was essentially an extension of the talk that I gave that got me in the door, which is like theme development. And so okay, so now I have that now. So now what's next? And so what I ended up doing, which ended up being pretty helpful, is like I was like, okay, well, I can buy Brad Williams's books, and I can read those books, and I could be like, okay, this chapter I'm going to turn into a class, and then I kind of did. So I was learning as I was going, which is actually a really good way to learn stuff, and
Absolutely.
because and just learning things from like a video course that you find on Pluralsight or LinkedIn Learning or wherever isn't always the best way of learning things. Like it's like there's all sorts of like, I don't know, studies, discussions, conversations around like the best way of learning, but like it's like you hear the thing and then you read the thing and then you do the thing and then it's like locked in your body, right?
Yeah.
So like for me it was like, okay, I was reading the thing in the book and then also like teaching it to someone else is also a way to like lock in the learning, right? So like for me doing an internationalization course, like I read a bunch of Otto's posts and I read some other stuff and then I, you know, did the course and now it's like that's burned into my brain. Like I'm never gonna forget that stuff.
Yeah, I think you're so right because it's one thing to conceptually understand something in your head or even be able to sit down, write the code and understand what you're doing, but to explain it to someone else makes it just forces your brain to work in a different way. And I think that just like that reinforces the knowledge and to be able to teach it, you have to understand it thoroughly. So I kind of learned that even before doing the courses, I was blogging and my blog started, or my WordPress blog started with tutorials. It was basically, hey, I learned how to do something. Let me tell you how. And going through and step by step explaining what you do, where you're putting something, why you're putting it there, and things to think about as you do X, Y, or Z, and kind of logicking through it and explaining just cemented the knowledge for me. So yeah, I think that, and everybody does have different learning, styles or ways that are best for them. But I've found that that's teaching the teacher. Wait, where, how to, I don't know. Yeah, that works for me.
In all of your years of doing WordPressy stuff, have you ever ventured into foreign territories of trying out other open source CMSs or other sort of projects just to kind of get a sense, or were you always kind of, no, I feel good here.
I have primarily and largely stayed in WordPress, which in retrospect, I wish I had have been broader. And we can talk about FAIR later, but coming into FAIR has opened my eyes considerably to the larger open source ecosystem. And there's so much out there and so many things, like there's just people do different things differently, and there's the opportunity to learn from how different open source projects work, how they govern, how they do all the things. And I've been a little bit like tunnel visioned because WordPress has been my experience. So I wish I'd made an effort earlier to at least dip my toes, and not necessarily to the extent of my involvement with WordPress, but just to understand how some of these other CMSs worked.
Yeah, well, we can segue off into FAIR. I'm interested in like how you first sort of got involved in the project.
Well, not to, I'm sure you've talked about it on the show, and I don't need to rehash any drama, but after happenings in the community in September of a couple of years ago, I was appalled and frustrated, and the issues or the concerns that were raised around governance and ownership, these were not new concerns. I realized I had just been ignoring them and living in my happy la la land, and thinking it would not impact me. And then that was just sort of a wake up call of, oh, this is not okay. And something we need something better. And so just through conversations with like-minded folks, I started involving myself in what would eventually become the joining of several groups to become FAIR. And the whole purpose behind that was let's fix the supply chain problem of what if somebody turns WordPress.org off, because we can't control that. If somebody turns it off, how are we still powering our sites and receiving updates? So that was where it started, was a technical problem, but that was also very much a business problem too.
Yeah, well, and that's not even a hypothetical thought experiment about what happens if somebody turns WordPress.org
You're
off,
right. It
because
happened.
it very literally happened for just for a very specific audience. And that is sort of part of the, yeah, that's why we're doing this, I think, message of what FAIR is. So what is your role officially, unofficially within FAIR now?
I am a co-chair, as you mentioned, and as we started, so I'll just to back up in context, like this was all new territory for me, like in terms of how to set up governance and how an open source body of contributors works. And I'm very grateful to the Linux Foundation, who came in early on and supported FAIR and still supports FAIR, for their guidance, because they've seen it all and of course know what best practices look like. And so when we formed a technical steering committee, which is a common a TSC, which is a common term across open source communities. And that was just a body of people that were contributing to the project. And then within that, you have people that have different levels of access, right? So you have people that maybe they submit a PR or whatever, they're a contributor, or they show up to a meeting, they participate in a conversation, they're contributing. And then you have a next step up, which is organizers, and those are sort of your core team, your voting members. And then somebody leads the helm of that herding cats, if you will. And that is a chair. And in the case of FAIR, we opted to have three co-chairs instead of a single. And I'm really glad of that because it brings a diversity in terms of just personalities and perspectives that I think has been beneficial for the project so far. But anyhow, was elected to serve as a co-chair, and that was actually a little over a year ago at this point. So by the time that this airs, there will probably have been a new round of elections for co-chairs. And
wow.
Yeah.
I haven't even thought about that. Wow. Yeah. Talk about, like, so obviously, like, yeah, there was a lot of tension in the WordPress community following that one fateful WordCamp US. There's obviously been a lot of drama, and that's not particularly new, although a long-standing like lawsuit and legal case has probably not happened, I don't think. Not to the degree that it is right now, happened in WordPress's history. So like that's all like part of it, but like what about FAIR and sort of like the operational goal of the project do you like feel is worth sort of being like volunteering your time and your energy towards?
Well, in all honesty, a lot of my time and energy was with the hope that we would find widespread adoption in the WordPress community. And at the moment that hasn't happened, and maybe it could still materialize. I don't know. I'm glad that FAIR was built in a way to be agnostic and usable by other CMS communities, or really anybody ultimately that needs package management. But so that's specific, but zooming outside of that a little bit, I love the idea of, okay, I'm going to go back and give an example. You're in your WordPress admin. You inherit a site and it's running 50 plugins and 34 of them are out of date. And short of just YOLOing it and hitting the update button or the update all, or even going through some sort of a mechanism where you're, testing for regressions and all that, you're a little bit blind. All you know is there's an update available from a source. And so back to your question and FAIR, the whole idea of getting trust signals for a package and verifying that a package is who it's supposed to be from, coming from the destination it's supposed to be from, is verified in terms of there are no active security vulnerabilities that are known. Just the level of confidence, I feel like that brings to someone managing a site is huge. And, FAIR gives the ability to do something that currently just doesn't exist in like if we're comparing it to WordPress plugins.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about that point in particular is that as we are recording this, Cloudflare just announced their MDASH, which is their reimagining, but actually sort of quasi fork of WordPress. That runs on Astro and lives in the cloud using service workers and things. But one of their fundamental arguments of how and why they built the architecture the way that they did was this idea of the plugin ecosystem in WordPress. I think broken is probably maybe too strong of a word, but is impaired, is potentially problematic when you can have 34 plugins that are out of date. Many of those maybe have security vulnerabilities. Many of those might already be exposed or have already been infected by these vulnerabilities.
Right.
And having files written to your file system and the whole like premise with the way that they built the plugin architecture in MDASH was these things are going to like live in isolation away from your code base or away from the rest of it. So it can't do that thing because they're identifying all of those vulnerabilities. They're identifying all the CVEs that every year that WordPress that mostly comes out of plugins and outdated plugins. And you can, use PatchDAC, you can use WordFence, you can use things that like inform and tell you to update your stuff, and you can have automatic updates and whatever, but like that doesn't solve the problem across the board. There's always going to be that sort of potential for security. And then also, like, going back to the original premise, like if a bad actor was working from within the system, which is not an impossible thing, from inside WordPress.org, or somehow managed a way to circumvent something to get their code out there. I mean, it's supply chain security is not is known outside of WordPress.
Right.
It's already like there's supply chain security issues in NPM all the time. So like having something where you can track and trace, verify where a package is coming from makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I briefly read about the MDASH this morning, and I'm very curious to take that for a spin.
Yeah. I'm interested to see how that works and where that goes. It's interesting that it's coming from someone like Cloudflare, which like not like I know lots of us in the WordPress ecosystem know Cloudflare. Lots of us probably use Cloudflare, but like it's not like they're an established player in our community to date. Like I think the first time I met anyone from Cloudflare I went to Bad Camp, which is Bay Area Drupal Camp, this last year, in October, I think. And they had a little table. They had two guys from Cloudflare, and it was the first time I'd ever seen them anywhere. Like ever. Which is really cool. I got to talk to the two guys from Cloudflare for a minute.
Well, I'm curious what their role was.
It was like a sales guy, and I think there was a developer guy, but he wasn't there when I was at the table.
Okay.
But yeah, so it was very like high level and not very technical. But I mean, like, that's also when, like, the thing that I was thinking about at the time back is, you know, again, back in September, October, whatever, is like the bot protection stuff, which I think was something they had recently done. And that was something that since like March of last year, we at Pantheon just saw like an explosion of like AI bot crawlers, just sending tons and tons of traffic to like sites and like really like ramping, like exponentially more traffic to these sites just from these scrapers. And then Cloudflare just like decided to build something for free that they're going to give to everyone. And so like, of course everybody is going to sign up for them. Right.
Right.
Yeah. So that was the sort of thing that I was thinking about at the time. And I was like, hey, what else you got cooking?
Well, now you know.
Yeah, right.
Well, I was already curious to try out Astro and just kind of understand the guts of that. I've also recently installed Typo3 locally, and I'm starting to play around with that. So I'm trying to learn from my previous single focus and branch out a little bit and be curious about other things out there.
Yeah. Well, and on the Typo3 thing, you know, obviously like a few months ago, Kareem Mirici and Joost de Valk said that they're taking a few steps back from FAIR because they tried to get funding and they weren't able to get funding. They weren't able to get buy-in from the folks that they were trying to do. And so there's been maybe some wind out of the sails, but like FAIR is still going on and there is interest from Typo3 leadership. And so talk about like what that looks like and what sort of like the present and or future of FAIR might be, especially in that it was built sort of to be like intended to be agnostic, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, Typo3, they had their hackathon in March, in late March, and Typo3 and FAIR did a project together, and then came out of that with a working implementation of FAIR running on Typo3 to serve with extensions, which is kind of akin to plugins. Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty cool to see. Like, it's actually being added into Typo3 core, like for baked in support. So I think that's a very real collaboration that's happening. I don't know how that will, I wasn't I wasn't at the hackathon, and there might be others like Brent or some other folks from the TSC that are better qualified to answer kind of what they think their future plans are there. But I think there's definitely opportunity for collaboration, and we'll see more coming out of that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to get Brent on here too, but yeah, I think that, you know, even from a WordPress perspective, I feel like it's the sort of thing where, like, you know, competition is good, right? And like, when you have a platform that is like built to be generic, and it's built to be generic, but yes, obviously, because we're all WordPress people, we're doing it in a WordPress context. But we built it so that anybody could use it. When somebody else is using it, that forces you to think about things that maybe you weren't thinking about before, right?
Yeah.
The thing that I've been talking about for, you know, a year, almost in FAIR, is like composer support. But broadly, composer, there's some agencies that use composer for WordPress, and there's like the Roots project that, you know, has been built around mm-hmm. composer. But like, it's in the Drupal ecosystem, composer is built into the platform, is built into how Drupal just functions, and WordPress has never operated with that sort of mode of functioning. So we as a WordPress community have never been forced to think about Composer in any sort of real supporting right. sort of sense. But here we are with this project, and we've made this project open, and my understanding is Typo3 does use Composer. So that is forcing us to have to figure out what does that actually mean. And the answer ultimately benefits everyone, right?
For sure. Yeah. As I understand it, they have a Composer version and a non-Composer version for people that don't want to go the Composer route. I think, you know, your comment about, you know, WordPress, it's not in core, at least not at the time that we're recording this. And WordPress has been such a wide open door for anybody that wanted to come on board and use it, that I think it has attracted over time a huge swath of people that are not developers.
Yeah.
So the user base is, I'm making a guess, but I'm going to say that it's a largely non-technical user base. So they don't, like, they're never going to open up a terminal and or you know, do a composer.json file or understand how or care how any of that works. But I think it is exciting, like you said, that seeing things that other projects use and how we can adapt FAIR. And I think you will find that Composer support is coming to FAIR. thank you for beating that drum along with some others. And that's exciting. It's just exciting. Like I use in my local development workflow, I use composerized versions of WordPress. And so it would be great to see that support extended.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's funny. You're talking about the user base of WordPress tends to lean less technical. And it's funny because it's the inverse. I feel like it's the inverse in the Drupal community. I've had several now Drupal developers and folks from the Drupal community on this podcast. And I've been to a couple of Drupal events, and the path of where Drupal core development is going and a lot of energy is going is actually in trying to pick up more of those non-technical users, because they have self-identified that they're in like the opposite problem, where it's very technical. In the Drupal ecosystem, there is like the concept of not just developers, but also site builders that are just like the people that do like the middleware, the configuration, mm-hmm. and like making sure the admin works in the way that you're supposed to do, because everything is like config based. Whereas in WordPress, we've never really needed that so much, because the WordPress UI and everything that you can do is pretty easy to use and accessible to kind of everyone. And what's not built there, there are like hooks and tools for developers to add there. But like for a normal person, they're just going to find a plugin to do that thing, right?
Right.
So I it's funny because like with WordPress, we have the one problem. And in Drupal, it's like literally the polar opposite.
The barrier to entry is too high.
Yes.
Well, yeah. And that, you know, that's been an argument even within discussions within the FAIR crowd of, you know, should there be that barrier to entry of knowing how to use Composer. Mm-hmm. And some people say, no, keep it a low barrier to entry. And other people say, well, this is a, you know, if it's something for developers, make it developer friendly. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. I've always found the question of Composer in WordPress really interesting because on the one hand, like, so as a developer, I want to use Composer in everything because I know, and my argument that I've said this in talks and things is that, by using Composer for WordPress, it means that whoever the person that is in control of your updates for your dependencies, your packages, your plugins and themes and whatever, and maybe WordPress core itself, is the person that knows how to deal with the problem of, oh, I updated something and now I have a white screen. So like a user who is clicking update on a WordPress plugin and then it white screens as a result of that has no idea what to do and nowhere to go from there. Mm. Whereas if I'm a developer and I'm tagging, you know, tipping one of those version points to the next version and that white screens, well, I know that I can fix that because I can just roll it back or I can, you know, find a patch or whatever. But then if you think about, like, I had this conversation with a product manager at Pantheon. He's like, well, what could you do something that was like Composer based but inside the admin somehow? And like a plugin that was also managing Composer files. And there's so many, like, it's weird. It's a weird headspace.
Yeah. I'm trying to wrap my head around that. My initial thought is, I think that would kind of defeat the purpose. And I think doing it in the context of WP admin, but maybe there is something out there.
I think there's a WP Composer plugin or something that kind of sort of does that. And obviously there's also a Composer project called Satis, which is you can host your own repositories. And so there's Satis Press, which kind of turns a WordPress site into a Satis server. So you could host your own sort of package manager inside of a WordPress site, which is also a weird thing. But like there's that fundamental tension of like, you know, a site owner versus a developer. And in WordPress, like there's like, I don't know, like it's, there's, those are two different personas. And I don't know that like a site owner should be a developer, but a developer could be a site owner, you know, like, but you shouldn't force a site owner. You shouldn't force a site owner to become a developer, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Right. No, I would agree with you there.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on, Carrie. This has been awesome. I loved chatting about LinkedIn learning and learning about all of that process. Where can people find you on the internet if they were to so go looking for you?
Come say hello. I'm carriedills.com is my website, and then my blue sky handle is also carriedills.com. Find me on LinkedIn, or I'm not super active. I'm more of a lurker and post status chat, but you can find me at cdills, D-I-L-S, over there. And yeah, love to say hello.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Carrie, for coming on. And thank you, everyone who might be watching or listening in the future. And we'll see you on the internet.
Thank you, Chris. Yeah.